From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
A few of us got together and decided that if it got to the point where the planes were due to be delivered to Indonesia, the only option we would have at that point would be to go in and non-violently disarm them ourselves.
Christian peace activists beat swords into plowshares. Today, in our Christmas Eve special, a look at the plowshares movement and a radio play based on the life of a Catholic priest now in prison. It's called A Clown, A Hammer, A Bomb, and God. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Terry Nichols was yesterday convicted on one count of conspiracy and eight counts of involuntary manslaughter in the massive truck bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, the nation's most notorious and deadliest act of domestic terrorism, which killed 168 people. He was acquitted on charges of using a weapon of mass destruction and of actually bombing the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. The federal jury of seven women and five men took 41 hours over 6 days to decide that Nichols had conspired with his Army buddy Timothy McVeigh to use a weapon of mass destruction in the April 19, 1995 attack. But by rejecting the first-degree murder charges in the deaths of eight law enforcement officials, the panel also concluded that Nichols had not intentionally meant to murder the people inside. And this news from Mexico. Witnesses say the killers had no mercy. They shot down women and children as they fled through a coffee plantation, stopping only to put a final bullet through the heads of the wounded as they lay in the muddy paths. Worse still, survivors allege the assassins were known members of a local branch of President Ernesto Zedillo's Institutional Revolutionary Party, known as the PRI. Police less than 2 miles away did not show up for 5 hours. That was the story told to Reuters by survivors from Mexico's worst massacre in years when paramilitaries tore through a refugee camp in the southern Mexican state of Chiapas yesterday, shooting dead 45 people and injuring dozens more. We're joined right now by Crystal Echolake. She's a member of the staff of the National Commission for Democracy in Mexico, which was commissioned by Subcomandante Marcos to represent the Zapatistas in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, can you tell us what news reports you have gotten from this village called Acteal in the southern state of Chiapas in Mexico and the conversations you've had with people there?
Well, basically what we have learned is that there are 45 deaths confirmed, 19 of which are small children, one newborn, and nine men, and the rest were women. Essentially, the gunfire went on for more than 4 hours. When the victims, just prior to the attack, the victims were actually gathering in a church holding mass. They were praying for peace when they were attacked. Therefore, they were completely defenseless and unarmed. Essentially, we are outraged at this. The Mexican government came on live television yesterday denying any involvement and pledged to use all resources at its, that it had to basically apprehend the culprits. And as you pointed out, police were less than 2 miles away and did not do anything and did not respond.
As I understand it now, the Mexican government says they have arrested 4 people. But what is the history of this kind of paramilitary violence? Could this have been predicted in Chiapas?
Yes, because essentially it cannot be seen in isolation from the low-intensity war that the Mexican government itself has been waging since 1994. It's been well documented by human rights groups such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch that these paramilitary groups have been acting in direct complicity with the Mexican Federal Army and state and federal officials. Just a few weeks ago, the governor of Chiapas gave 4.6 million pesos to one of the most notorious paramilitary groups called Justice and Peace. Therefore, what the paramilitary groups are being used as is a counterinsurgency tactic against the Zapatista communities. It's a way to undermine and terrorize that social base of support in an effort to literally beat these communities in submission, to get them to back down from what this struggle is about, which is about gaining indigenous rights.
And both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have put out reports on the violence there.
Yes, they have indeed. They have really come out strongly in the last couple of months condemning the Mexican government. And more groups from around the world are beginning to step forward, pointing out that the Mexican government is one of the most notorious human rights abusers, that they have violated almost every standard regarding human rights, and they have called for the implementation of these peace agreements that the Mexican government signed in February 1996.
Crystal Echo Hawk, I want to thank you very much for joining us for that brief explanation of what looks like about 50 people killed in Acteal in the southern state of Chiapas. Crystal Echo Hawk, a member of the staff of the National Commission for Democracy in Mexico. She's based in Los Angeles. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today in this Christmas Eve special, we're going to take a look at the plowshares movement. In the early 1980s, peace activists internationally began to take literally the biblical prophecy of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares. From nuclear weapons manufacturing sites to Minuteman missile silos, activists have physically attacked the weapons of war, hammering on control panels and spilling blood over communication systems. But the 150 plowshares activists who've been arrested at some 56 different protests, not one has been acquitted of criminal charges stemming from the actions. Nobody, that is, until this past year in Britain. Just a few days ago, I got a chance to speak with Andrea Needham. She's one of four women who took part in an all-woman plowshares action in Britain on January 29, 1996, when they disarmed a British Hawk fighter plane that was to be sent to Indonesia. They targeted this plane, and they targeted a weapon being sent to Indonesia because of its occupation of East Timor. They invaded East Timor 22 years ago and have committed one of the great genocides of the late 20th century, killed more than a third of the Timorese population. I spoke to Andrea Needham in New York City, where she had just given a speech, and started off by asking her why this unprecedented all-woman plowshares action.
Well, because plowshares in Britain, at least, ours was the third action, plowshares action in Britain, and it's been very male-dominated. All the previous activists have been men. And certainly in Britain, plowshares has been, I think, dismissed by the women's peace movement, which is the strongest element of the peace movement in Britain, as something largely irrelevant to women. And we wanted to reclaim that and say, you know, this is something that women can and do. And also, I think we all found working in a women's group easier than working in a mixed group.
So tell us about the morning of January 29th, 1996.
Well, we got buses and train to the site. It's sort of in the middle of nowhere, so it's very difficult to get to. And then we had to walk another 2 miles across the fields in the dark, which was kind of hard going because we were carrying so many tools to break into the hangar with. We got there and we waited in the darkness in the fields to see the security patrols going by. And we wanted to see two go by so we would know the distance in between patrols. And then when the second one we saw went by, then we decided we would go into the site. And before we did that, we had a minute's silence, and we stood in the ditch and held hands and thought about East Timor and why we were doing this, and really tried to focus on why it was that we were there. And I just got a real sense that we were doing the right thing.
What did you think about in that minute?
I thought about various images I'd seen of East Timor, but particularly of, I guess, the most graphic ones are the ones which come out of the Santa Cruz massacre in Dili in 1991. And I thought of an image I'd seen of a young boy standing in front of a banner which calls for self-determination for East Timor, and he's got this kind of resolute expression on his face, and he's holding up his hands and sort of victory signs. And I heard that he was actually shot later that day, and it just really made me think, you know, how terrible it is that Britain is selling weapons to a regime which thinks nothing of shooting small children, and that how right it was what we were doing.
So after that minute, what did you do? Yeah, I assume you had scoped out security and when the intervals were of when they moved around the plant.
Yeah, I mean, we'd spent many, many nights sitting outside the site watching it, so we knew, you know, what their routines were. We went up the fence and we cut through the fence and we hung peace cranes on it as a sort of symbol of our peaceful intentions. And then we...
Peace cranes like are used in Hiroshima.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it's some cranes I'd made. We hung them there. And then we went to the first door. The idea was that we would get into a fire exit. We'd break the door and then put our hands through and push the glass on the other side, push the bar, I'm sorry, on the other side. But we couldn't open that door at all. So we ran round the hangar to another door and we managed to force it with a crowbar and got in, and the plane which we'd identified as being an Indonesian one was right there in the hangar in front of us. And obviously we thought, you know, they must have noticed by then that we'd broken through all their security systems. So we were expecting the security to arrive any moment. So we started straight away hammering on this aircraft. We just had ordinary household hammers.
What did you hammer on?
Well, first of all, we hammered on the controls in the cockpit, which were to do with bomb targeting and release. And that was sort of our priority. But then, since nobody came, we carried on and we hammered on the nose, on the wings, on the fuselage, on the grounds that the whole thing is a weapon. So if you disable the wings, it can't take off, it can't go to Indonesia. So that's just as legitimate as disabling bomb mechanisms. So we hammered pretty much all over it, really.
Now, the security didn't come for a long time, actually, until you made a phone call, right? You found a plane and called the press of Britain.
That's right. It had always been our intention to stay there and take full responsibility for what we'd done. But it turned out to be harder than we'd expected because British Aerospace didn't notice we were there at all. And
you left a video?
Yeah, we'd made a video which had a lot of information about the situation in East Timor, as well as interviews with the four of us explaining what we were going to do and our motivation for doing it. And we wanted to, well, firstly leave it so that if we weren't allowed to talk about the issues at trial, that we hoped it would be used as evidence against us. But also we wanted to leave it in the cockpit of the plane, on the pilot's seat, as a sort of symbolic way of saying, this is what's happening in East Timor, and, you know, please don't fly this plane to Indonesia. So we left that there, and we hung banners up, and we stuck photographs on the plane, people killed in East Timor, and then we tried to attract the attention of security guards, and we kept going outside and waving at the security patrols as they drove around, but they didn't notice us at all. And eventually, we found a telephone, and first we called up our friends in the support group to tell them what we'd done, and then we called up the press association to tell them what we'd done, and we asked them to call British Aerospace for a comment. And they obviously did that, and a few minutes later, a couple of security guards arrived, and we were taken off, and they called the police, and we were arrested.
What were you charged with?
We were charged with criminal damage and conspiracy to commit criminal damage. The amount of the damage went up and down, but it ended up at about £1.7 million.
We're talking to Andrea Needham, one of four women who took part in a Plowshares action in Britain on January 29, 1996, where they disarmed a British Hawk plane that was to be sent to Indonesia. They were arrested after the disarming, the hammering on the plane, and the various control panels inside the plane. You were kept in prison for how long before trial?
We were in prison for 6 months.
Then the trial took place in July of 1996. What happened there?
Well, at trial, we argued that what we'd done wasn't a crime, because in British law, you're allowed to use reasonable force to prevent crime. And this was simply what we'd been doing. We'd use reasonable force to prevent the crime of murder in East Timor, which this plane would have been used for. And we were allowed to call witnesses to the situation in East Timor, including José Ramos Horta, Timorese representative to the UN,
who won the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right. He won the Nobel Peace Prize along with Bishop Belo of East Timor last year. And we were allowed to talk extensively ourselves about what we knew about East Timor and our motivation for taking this action. So all that evidence was allowed to be presented to the jury, and they were allowed to consider this defence of using reasonable force to prevent crime.
What about the prosecution witnesses that were brought forward? This was British Aerospace, is that right?
That's right. There were a number of British aerospace witnesses, and it was really the first time that we'd actually been able to ask them any questions, because any time we'd tried to meet with them before, they'd just refused or stonewalled, and it was good to actually have them there in court, and they had to answer our questions.
There were four of you. One had a lawyer, three of you didn't, so that you could mainly represent yourselves, just get legal counsel when things were difficult. What did you ask the representative from British Aerospace?
Well, one man in particular, who's a manufacturing manager, I think, he'd been talking extensively about the damage we'd done to the plane and about every last dent in the plane and every last piece of glass we'd smashed and all these technical terms and jargon which nobody understood. And I was sitting there kind of feeling sicker and sicker that there was so much evidence about, you know, every last little hole in this plane, and what nobody was saying, what is this plane going to be used for? Aren't there more important issues here? So when it was my turn to cross-examine him, I stood up and said, you know, you're clearly very concerned about the damage we've done to this aircraft, but do you have any concern at all for the people of East Timor who would have been damaged by it had it been sold to Indonesia? And he just looked at me and said, no. And I think, for me, that kind of summed up the whole attitude of British Aerospace. They really didn't care what the Indonesians did with their weapons. As long as they got the money, that was the only thing that concerned them.
The jury heard that. The jury actually watched your video.
Yes, they watched the video twice, in fact. And the video has very graphic scenes of footage taken during the Santa Cruz massacre in Dili. And they were clearly, just watching them, they were clearly very affected by that. I think it'd be hard not to be affected by, you know, scenes of people being, you know, running and screaming and being shot. And it also basically laid out the whole history of East Timor and the issue of British complicity in the Indonesian occupation.
So, what happened on verdict day?
Well, it was kind of a nerve-wracking day, obviously. It was like our future for the next few years was about to be decided.
How long was the trial?
It was 6 days. And then the jury was sent off, and they came back after about 4 hours and said they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict, so they were allowed to go off and try for a majority verdict. And they came back about half an hour later, and they'd said there was a verdict. And, yeah, it was a strange kind of time. We were all sitting there waiting for these verdicts, sort of sitting there holding hands, and I was telling myself that, you know, in a sense, we'd gone into this expecting nothing less than several years in prison, and what we'd done was right, and we knew that, and so in a sense, the verdict was irrelevant, because nothing could change the fact that we'd done the right thing. But at the same time, I was thinking, you know, I've been in prison 6 months, and I really found it quite difficult, and I really don't want to go back there. So there were seven verdicts, eight verdicts to be read, I'm sorry, because each person gets a separate verdict on each charge, and each one is read individually. So when he stood up and, you know, the foreman said not guilty on the first charge, there was just this kind of huge gasp around the courtroom, and the judge yelled for silence, and then it just kept on coming, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, until we were all acquitted on all charges.
So they got the message.
I guess so. Well, the jury got the message. But I'm not sure that, you know, the British government and British Aerospace did.
Was this decision unprecedented?
It was, yes. It was the first acquittal in Ploughshares history, as was the 56th Ploughshares action, and it's the only one that's ended in a complete acquittal.
What was the response of the press?
Well, there was a massive response. I mean, it was really, really big news, and we were completely mobbed by the press. The fact that, you know, 200 or 250,000 people have been killed in East Timor during this occupation has never been news, and they've never been interested in that and aren't particularly interested in it now. But the fact that we had been acquitted was huge news, because they could wheel out their worst prejudices and all their lots of sort of nasty misogynistic attacks, and you know, they could be outraged at how this could have been allowed to have happened. How could these women have been allowed to have been acquitted? You know, what's wrong with the jury system? And people were calling for inquiries into the jury system. But at the same time, as at least, you know, it was there, at least the issue was in the news, and probably for the first time ever in Britain, you know, an issue involving East Timor was on the front page of the papers, and it was on, at the top of the news. And
Andrea Needham, one of four women who took part in a Plowshares action in Britain, will continue with this conversation when we come back from our break here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with our Christmas Eve special and finish up our conversation with Andrea Needham, one of four women who took part in a Plowshares action in Britain on January 29, 1996, when they hammered on the head of a British Hawk fighter plane that was to be sent to Indonesia. She's just described the trial and the unprecedented acquittal of all four women for damaging this weapon of mass destruction. I went on to talk about today.
So what is your response today? What is your reaction to what happened to you and your plans for the future?
Well, I think my response is that, you know, it's, I think what we did was very important. And I think our acquittal was enormously important in terms of the profile of East Timor and the issue of arms sales to Indonesia. But it's just one step along the way. And we're just, you know, a small group of people, and you know, there are thousands and thousands of people also involved in the campaign. And I just see it as one step. It's not the end of the campaign. Britain's still selling weapons to Indonesia. Britain, the United States, and many other governments are still actively complicit in what Indonesia is doing. And we need to carry on campaigning. So as far as I'm concerned, it's not necessarily more of the same at the moment, but, you know, more continued campaigning. I think that's, you know, we owe that to the people of East Timor because our governments are just doing such dreadful things there.
In hearing you recently give a speech, you said that when you were in prison, you got letters from many different people all over the world.
That's right. I mean, we got thousands of letters. Prison officers never stopped complaining, actually, because they had to read them all. But and we also got letters from people in East Timor and even from Timorese prisoners in Indonesian jails, which was just, it was just amazing to know that, you know, they'd heard about it in their jail cell and they'd actually managed to get a letter out to us. It was just this tremendous feeling of, you know, solidarity, sort of prison-to-prison solidarity across the world.
What did the prisoners, the Timorese prisoners, write?
They wrote that, you know, they felt very supported by this and that very often they feel like people don't know what's happening in East Timor or people don't care what's happening in East Timor. And it helps them tremendously to know that people in the West, whose governments are complicit in the situation, do know and do care and are prepared to take action to try and stop what's going on.
Andrea Needham, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Andrea Needham, one of the Plowshares four in Britain who were acquitted after hammering on a British Hawk plane that was supposed to be sent to Indonesia.
There is no silence deep enough.
There is no silence deep enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No corruption thick enough.
No politician bent enough.
No politician bent enough.
To bury your story. To keep it from us.
Bury your story and keep it from us.
Love from a short distance.
Love from a short distance.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like to find out more about the East Timor Plowshares Action or about this CD, Love from a Short Distance, compilation CD for the children of East Timor, you can call 914-428-7299. That's 914-428-7299. As we continue with our Christmas Eve special on Plowshares Activism. In 1994, Good Friday fell on April Fool's Day, and so on Good Friday, 1994, a Catholic priest named Carl Cabot dressed as a clown. He then went out to a Minuteman missile site in North Dakota, where he used a hammer to bend the guide rail that allows the missile silo to open. Cabot, a longtime peace activist, was sentenced to prison for this action. Father Cabot is part of a movement called the Plowshares. The Plowshares, a group of pacifists who take literally the biblical prophecy of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares. Since 1980, there have been more than 56 Plowshares protests that have resulted in the arrests of over 150 peace activists. Father Cabot's action was the inspiration for a new play entitled A Clown, a Hammer, a Bomb, and God by playwright Dan Kinch. The play is now on tour. Today, actor Ben Roberts will enact a short passage from the play. In this passage, the play's main character, Father Ben, explains the destructive capability of the weapon he's targeted for disarming and his justification for taking action to disable the missile.
Hello! I'm here. We can start. My name is Father Ben. And I'm not an alcoholic. If you're here to listen to the morning 12-step program, you've tuned in on the wrong day. I can't talk about alcoholism. It isn't my area of expertise.
I am here to make a joyful noise.
I'm very tired right now. My sleep is disturbed by the masters of war. I've thought about the preparations for their weapons and how they all come to bring me here. To beautiful North Dakota. And here we are. I'm a little tired from all of the nightmares of their weapons. The nightmares follow me everywhere. And I'm tired from preparing for this day. I've been praying and thinking about this moment for months. This moment has come to me, and now it's here. My task is to do the best I can to make the unholy holy. Or at least to disarm it as best I can. I'll try to anticipate your questions. First of all, I am a priest. This performance is about a clown, a hammer, a bomb, and God. It says so right at the top of the hour. So I'll be able to talk to you about some things that are pertinent, but for right now, I don't have nearly enough time to talk about everything. First, you should know there's a sign over there. U.S. Air Force shoot to kill line. I'm already on the wrong side of the line. When I crossed the shoot to kill line, I set off a motion detector. Some poor Air Force sentry is driving out here in a blue Humvee. He'll get here in about 30 minutes, and he'll see me, and he'll put an M16 up to his shoulder and get me in that Canadian bull sight they call it, and pop! I'm one down clown. I have volunteered my life for the work I'm doing. You gave up a morning. You could have been listening to a shock jock. No one expects you to put your lives on the line here. So I've introduced myself, and now you know what everything is here. Now, you're wondering what the title is about.
Truth in Advertising applies to this show.
I'm dressed as the clown. I'm holding a hammer. Any doubters? No one wants to join me in the shoot-to-kill zone, huh? You'll have to take my word that I'm holding a hammer. Actually, I have to let you in on a little secret. I'm not afraid of that young man I told you about. That young man in the sack camouflage pattern uniform with the blue beret and the M16. He doesn't want to kill me. He doesn't want to kill anyone. Even in war, men don't hit each other very often. I've worked with men who went to Vietnam in the infantry. And most of them fired blindly at bushes, hoping to scare the enemy away. Young men with rifles in hand. They're another play altogether. but they're not why we're here today. Young men with rifles are not what we're here to stop. Anyway, we were discussing the parts of the title. We're now looking for a bomb, and for God, in descending order. Well, there's no bomb in my bag. No, the bomb is in the silo, about 10 feet away. Under these case-hardened doors here is a hard-target silo for a Minuteman missile. If we could move the doors aside, you could look down there and see a silo about 100 feet deep. And in that silo is a Minuteman III missile, ready to fire. You'll have to take the missile on faith. Because you've all taken dumber things on faith, I know. If you could see the way these doors slide away to let the missile launch in the time of an attack, you'd know right away that I'm not fooling around here. Okay, I'll grant you, I got into this base pretty easily. I know what you're going to say. Father Ben, if there were really nuclear weapons under that silo, why would they protect them with a cyclone fence that any fool could cut through with a pair of tin snips? I can't answer that one. I've gotten into many different military bases over the last 14 years, and I didn't break a sweat getting into any of them. One of the reasons I don't fear death is that I hope I'll be able to meet someone in heaven who can tell me what these folks were thinking when they put nuclear weapons behind chicken wire fences. Trust me, there's a nuclear-armed missile over there. Take the missile on faith. It's there. Now, about God. I am a religious man. I think of the way God speaks through the actions of people every day. You might be Buddhists or Muslims or Jews. I cannot guarantee that my God will make a personal appearance this evening. J.D. Salinger would be easier to guarantee than my God. And there's no guarantee that all of you will see God even if he deigns to appear. It's like the bomb. You'll have to take it on faith. And since I don't know everyone's beliefs, I'll try to keep the Bible quotes to a minimum. I have some terrific chapters out of the Gospels that apply, and there's always Isaiah. However, be warned. There are some occasions when God's word has to come into play. The title of tonight's work is somewhat misleading. There's a missile down there, not a bomb. There are 30 Hiroshimas on that missile, not separate bombs, but one bomb. With 30 times the explosive power of the one that the United States dropped on Hiroshima, Japan, that bomb was called Fat Boy. Little big man Boy George, the point is it was called something relatively inoffensive. The truly cynical of our age call it the Fat White Boy bomb. The only people it's trusted with are white people, and the only people it was ever used on were not white. Survivors of the Hiroshima bombing said it made the sky glow like 1,000 suns had come up. And this was one bomb. Our bomb in that tube, even though it can cause hundreds of times the damage that little big Fat White Boy George caused, it doesn't have a name. That's right. A bomb that can light up the sky like 1,000 suns isn't special enough to have a name anymore. Oh, the Air Force has a designation for it. It is missile number M-29 of the U.S. Air Force 321st Strategic Missile Wing. M-29. That's a bus, not a missile. There are 30 Hiroshimas wrapped in that missile tube, and the Air Force can't name it. Well, a couple of years ago, some peace activists named it the Disarmingly Simple. Really. We tried to name the missiles sarcastic names because, well, there are 525 missiles, and not every one of them can be named the Auschwitz Special. Our friend Disarmingly Simple has 250,000 tons of high explosives, and Disarmingly Simple can carry multiple warheads. 330-kiloton white boy bombs. The Hiroshima bomb, which lit up the sky like 1,000 suns, blew up with the force of 12 kilotons. Now figure 30 times the Hiroshima blast times 3 warheads equals X. If 12 kilotons equals brightness 1,000 times the suns, carry the 2. I'm sorry, I'm really tired right now, as I said. Anyway, The point is, the missile in the silo is carrying weaponry far beyond need. I'm sure you all saw the headlines in the New England Journal of Medicine. Researchers agree the world doesn't need more than one sun at a time. One of the events in my life that put me on this path is a trip I took to Japan many years ago. It was when the memories of the bombing were more raw than they are now. When Fat White Boy detonated over Hiroshima in 1945, the light from it was so bright it burned into buildings. And people standing in front of those buildings had their shadows burned into the stone and brick and concrete. It's all there in the museum they set up in Hiroshima after the war. You could stand in front of a building all day, every day, for 100 years, and your shadow wouldn't burn into it. It takes a single fat white boy bomb to do in a tenth of a second what God's Son can't do in 100 years, and disarmingly simple has almost 100 times the power of fat white boy. Enough of that. Now we need to discuss Star Wars, the movie. It's TIE Fighter versus X-Wing.
I have you now, Luke Skywalker. Give up now or I shall destroy you.
Oh, no. Darth's behind me. I won't make any more HBO movies. I was trying to think of a way to explain all of this, and I thought about the Star Wars movies. We can all agree that the Empire is pure evil. They blow up Alderaan just to make a point. They're rude to a princess. They kill Ewoks, these nice indigenous peoples whose weapons are far outmatched by the Empire's science. Those Imperial forces, they're just so militaristic. All of those uniforms and guns and patrolling and locking people up for no good reason. You know the Empire has a much higher incarceration rate than the rebels. So let's take my hammer and smash the Empire! Only one problem. Many years ago, I worked with young men who'd gone to Vietnam. They didn't want to kill anybody. They just wanted to do their service and get out. The war damaged them, haunted their sleeping and waking hours. And our Gulf War veterans, so many of them were over in the Gulf because the local GM plant at home is padlocked. So war is rough on the soldiers who fight it, but wars are always hardest on the defenseless. And we identify with movies when we can't find the words to say what we mean. Which brings us back to Star Wars. You know, to a Vietnamese kid sitting in Ho Chi Minh City's only movie theater, it's so obvious who the evil empire is. And then there's Iraq. If you're living in what was once beautiful downtown Baghdad and you're able to find a bootleg copy of Star Wars and run it on your VCR during the 4 hours a day that Baghdad actually has electricity as a result of the war, you've got a whole different perspective on who the evil empire is. So when an Iraqi kid watching the tape says, "Smash the empire," he's probably talking about us. Americans. The people who bombed his house. My God. I'm in the Empire. When they talk about the evil empire, they're talking about you and me. You see, the children are also in my nightmares. In Iraq and Vietnam and, yes, the United States, those children are going hungry. Thousands of Iraqi children have died from malnutrition and dysentery since the war, and Vietnamese children went hungry long after American troops left. Because Vietnam has to pay its military. The Russians have to feed the army. In every country in the world, the masters of war always get to sit down first at the dinner table. If you're a child, you eat last. That's the truth from Moscow to Mobile, Alabama. Maybe I was called to be a clown today for the children. Maybe even the children of Iraq would laugh at a clown on a day like this. Now, I'm not here to defend anyone's government. I know many of you believe Iraq is evil. Many Iraqis believe Iraq is evil. But Iraqis are probably just trying to get by. And for some people, Iraq was probably a great place to live before the war. And that's another thing that's missing from the Star Wars movies. Somebody had to like living in the Empire. There had to be someone in the Empire who thought, hey, They're going to build a Death Star. I can get a government contract for the electrical work on that. And next year, I'll be able to buy a Millennium Falcon with a jacuzzi. And all those stormtroopers, are the stormtroopers volunteers? Was the Empire's economy really lousy and this was the only job a young Wookiee with no technical skills could get? Or are the stormtroopers draftees? There's a whole new light on the first movie, isn't it?
Actor Ben Roberts, playing Father Ben in A Clown, A Hammer, A Bomb, and God, will come back to this production in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! On this Christmas Eve, I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with the radio play A Clown, A Hammer, A Bomb, and God, about Catholic priest Carl Cabot, who dressed as a clown on Good Friday 1994, went out to a Minuteman missile site in North Dakota, where he bent the guide rail that allows the missile silo to open using a hammer. Now actor Ben Roberts playing Father Ben.
Here's some poor draftee stormtrooper waiting for his release from active duty and for his final duty assignment. He was lucky. They didn't send him to the ice planet or some other hellhole. No siree. He's got a nice cushy job on the new Death Star, where it's always warm and you don't get shot at. This kid is waiting for the shuttle flight back home to civilian life when Luke Skywalker drops the proton torpedo down the exhaust port. I mean, it's probably only hurt for a few seconds, but it really, really hurt. During those seconds. So I can't smash the Empire's TIE fighters. I know the young men inside them. And even if I don't, my God says thou shalt not kill. I've read dozens of translations of the Bible, and none of them, not once in any of them, was there an asterisk next to that commandment. Never. Not ever. For almost 1,700 years, Christians have been pretending there's an asterisk next to thou shalt not kill. Isn't. There isn't one in Hebrew or Aramaic or Greek or Latin or any of the other early translations of the Bible we've found. And scholars of the Torah never found an asterisk in all the antecedents to their book either. And that leads me back to the missile. Do you know where this missile is pointed? Do you? Okay, neither do I exactly, but let's say for the sake of argument, it's pointed at Kiev. Kiev, now part of the Ukraine nation. Kiev was a city 1,000 years ago when Moscow was just goat carts and mosquitoes. Kiev was visited by many a marauding Mongol in its early years. It took a pasting in the Napoleonic War, and it got mangled again pretty badly when the Germans rolled through it in 1943. Kiev is no stranger to bullets and cannon shot, and you know what? All of that destructive power, everything the Mongols, French, and Germans unleashed on poor Kiev, can't begin to compare with 30 Hiroshimas. Now, is Kiev still part of an evil empire? The last I heard, the people of Kiev were lobbying for a McDonald's. The missiles that used to protect Kiev are being turned into saleable spare parts by the soldiers who haven't been paid. If leaders who inherited the Soviet Union aren't paying the soldiers who guard the nuclear weapons, and they aren't paying to keep them up, how dangerous could they be? And if we really wanted to stop them, why don't we just write them a check? Ukrainians have to eat. Maybe they would trade their rusting missiles for a few thousand dollars. Maybe we can buy their missiles for a few thousand Happy Meals. I don't know about you, but I'm not scared of a country where you could buy their best weapons for McDonald's gift certificates. And I'm trying to put this use of our weaponry in the perspective of a Ukrainian. I'm pretending I'm living in Kiev, and I'm saving up my paychecks for months until I have enough money for an Arch Deluxe. My salary isn't keeping up with inflation. There aren't enough jobs anyway. The food and water is suspect ever since the Chernobyl plant blew up, and the future looks lousy. So why are those Americans spending all the treasures of the world to threaten me? Why are they still pointing weapons at me? If I were living in Kiev, I would personalize it. I'd start asking, what's wrong with these people? And you see, that brings us back to the other Star Wars, the one Ronald Reagan was so happy about. Well, part of it's already up there. Somewhere about 200 miles above us are the Navstar satellites. They sit up there in geosynchronous orbits and map out hundreds of coordinates a second. And if our Minuteman missile ever left its nice warm silo here, there's a chance it would get to its target without any Russian missiles taking off, because Navstar will be up there guiding all of those nice Trident submarine-launched missiles into Kiev first. Then the cruise missiles will come in from Europe, Pershing and Tomahawk cruise missiles. Will disable all of Russia's retaliatory missiles. Then Kiev is a sitting duck, with nothing to protect it and no way for it to fire back, just like when the Death Star attacked Alderaan. And this brings us back in a roundabout way to that young Air Force man in the snappy beret, the one who drew the short straw for guard duty today. The one who, I trust, will not want to shoot a clown on Good Friday. Now, if you gave him all of the ammunition he could carry and flew him out to Kiev and told him to kill everyone he could, just keep pulling that trigger till everyone was dead, could he do it? I'd like to believe he couldn't. Even if his rifle never ran out of ammunition, and even if the residents of Kiev were cooperative, I don't think he could do it. Oh, he may pretend he's Rambo in the barracks, but when he's got women and children in his sights, he's not going to do this for long. I believe he won't be able to do it. And yet, if the masters of war sit that same young man in a control booth and give him the key to the Minuteman missile with our friend Fat White Boy Bomb on board and give him the order, he'll turn the key every time. It's called training. It's called remote control death. The young man who would never be able to kill children with a rifle will be the cog in the machine that kills millions of children. And that's what's frightening me. That's what makes me think of Kiev. Now we're back. We're here. I'm 10 feet away from the silo that holds the death sentence for everyone within 30 miles of Kiev. None of us want this missile to fly over and blow up the city of Kiev, do we? Well, your name is on the missile, and so is mine. It says us right on it. If you've been paying taxes and living in the confines of the law, you can't pretend you didn't think the missile going off over Kiev was a good idea. You can't even pretend, the way the German civilians did after World War II, that you didn't know. Even if you don't read the papers or watch television, you can never say you didn't know anymore.
I told you.
After today, you'll never be able to say you didn't know.
You're welcome.
Oh, and you can't hide behind a party label on this one either. Ronald Reagan was just finishing what Jimmy Carter had already started, a first strike capability. Bill Clinton never offered to take these weapons apart, never decided to evict the missiles from their happy homes on the Great Plains. The Minuteman missile dates back to the 60s. There's plenty of blame to go around. Now you say, Father Ben, what can I do? Well, you can write a letter to your congressman or your senators or the president. Nothing will happen. But you can write to your congressman or your senators or the president. You can vote. But in all the years I've voted, there's never been a question about nuclear weapons. You know, I've voted on bond issues, on gambling casinos, on sales tax options. I've voted for both parties, and I've voted for people who weren't a part of either party. But I never had a chance to vote against nuclear weapons, never had a chance to vote about the Gulf War, never voted on a Pentagon budget. Sometimes the nightmare I have about the weapons isn't about the weapons at all. It's about the silence.
I read the newspapers every day, and I watch television, and no one talks about these things, these machines of death. They still camp out, taking food from our children and poisoning our water and our air and poisoning our minds, making us believe nuclear weapons belong here. They're part of the landscape. You'd think they were in Frederick Remington landscapes, the way everyone accepts them.
Well, I don't accept them.
There was a time when they weren't here. When the Sioux owned these hills, they weren't here. White men took the first photograph of these black hills, and the missiles weren't here. Clapboard wagons and Model Ts crisscrossed these plains. They weren't here. You can play Where's Waldo with all those old photographs. Disarmingly simple, and friends weren't here. They just weren't. All over the world, there are people who have the same nightmares I have. We've tried to persuade the masters of war to turn off the assembly lines, but the masters of war keep the missiles and the warheads and strategic bombers and submarines rolling off the assembly line. They teach us to harden our hearts. They act as if the building of weapons of mass destruction is a social program.
We have to continue to build Seawolf submarines. It's for the sake of Connecticut's economy.
Many years ago, a group of us got together and prayed and thought and studied and decided the only thing we could do was disarm the weapons ourselves. We'd explain our actions as a justified prevention of the crime of nuclear war. We would symbolically turn swords into plowshares, as it says in Isaiah, an act not of civil disobedience, but of divine obedience. It's an uphill task. If the Empire wants weapons of mass destruction, they will have them, and lots of them. So our actions are purely symbolic. With persuasion off the table, there's only one thing I can do. I can disable this missile so it won't fire. I can keep this missile from being active for a couple of hours or a couple of days. I think of it as a way of saying that I do not acquiesce. I do not vote with the dark side. My God and my religion compels me to stop the evil empire any way I can. I do not have the choice not to do this. And what is your role in all of this? If you are not compelled, as I am, how do you fit in? You have listened. The blackout of information about the plowshares and our actions no longer applies to you. If you're feeling uneasy about living in a country that continues to develop and build weapons of mass destruction, now you know you're not alone. Maybe one of you will follow me. Maybe one of you will serve on my jury. Maybe one of you will choose to let me speak my piece when it comes time for a sentence. And the day I go to trial and am acquitted, maybe that's when things change. Time is wasting. This is not my first plowshares action. In 1980, I went into a General Electric plant and hammered apart three missile nose cones, kept an MX missile from being produced for a day or so. Maybe it also caused the workers to slow down their work for a while. I'll bet none of you ever heard of it, did you? Did you hear about that September morning when Ann Montgomery, Elmer Moss, Daniel and Philip Berrigan, Molly Rush, Dean Hammer, John Shushart, and Carl Cabot all went into a GE plant and voted against the dark side? No, the New York Times decided we weren't fit news to print. The Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune, none of the TV networks. Oh, all of you were treated to plenty of pictures of Reagan's colon. You got every minute of the Super Bowl party for the Gulf War, but none of you saw a plowshares action on your 6 o'clock news. I've been arrested 4 times for work against nuclear weapons, work against the Empire. 4 times I've gone to prison in the Empire's prisons because I do not acquiesce. I do not agree. To be outside in the world, outside of a prison and free, when these weapons still threaten the lives of women and children, that would mean that I agree with the presence of these weapons, so I must act in the way I act. If I have to do it again and again, then I have no choice. And if I die in prison, it is for something. It is to let the whole world know that I do not agree with a culture of death, that I don't agree with a place where the masters of war feed and the children starve, where we poison ourselves to develop weapons that carry the potential of poisoning the entire world. I'm saying I do not agree in the loudest voice I can, in my own distinctive voice, of course. Today, which fell on the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, is Good Friday. On this day, Jesus triumphed over death. He died so that I might live. And so today, I'm compelled to be a fool for Christ, to wear these clothes and to take up arms against this weapon, which is ungodly in its very existence. By my actions today, his children shall sleep safely for a few nights, and my foolishness shall not go in vain.
Amen.
Today I'm here to disarm that missile. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to devour my flesh, my adversaries and foes, they stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war rise up against me, yet I will be confident. Now my head is lifted up above my enemies all around me. I will in his tent offer sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now at the point of the show where I commit a Class 1 felony. I'm going to take my hammer and bend the rail that guides the silo door so it will not open. Bending that rail will set off a secondary alarm, which will ring on every Air Force base in North Dakota. And our young SAC airman driving out here will put on his siren and see just how fast his Humvee can go. Thank you all for listening. You've been a wonderful audience. May I wish all of you and yours a peaceful Christmas and a hopeful new year.
An excerpt of the play, A Clown, A Hammer, A Bomb, and God, performed by Ben Roberts, written by Daniel Kinch. For more information on the play, you can call 212-841-0105. That's 212-841-0105. For a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Today, the United States still maintains the world's largest arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. The 9 plowshares activists who disarmed a few of them and remain behind bars are Steve Baggerly, Tom Lewis Borbley, Mark Colville, Susan Crane, Stephen Kelly, Tom and Donna, Howard Hastings, Philip Berrigan, and of course, Father Carl Cabot, on whom this play was based. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, Father Berrigan's brother, Father Daniel Berrigan, will join us for a Christmas Day special on Catholic worker founder Dorothy Day, currently being considered for sainthood. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, technical director Errol Maitland, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.